I want to start by reading something from an interview with Joko, and we can talk. Someone asked Joko, "You keep insisting on the importance of daily practice." She says, "It isn't something that we want to do, but that's what keeps you getting more porous all the time. A lot of people, though, even though their practice is going well, will read a book and come in and say, 'You know, Joko, in the 3 or 4 years that I've worked with you, everything in my life has transformed. I have a happy marriage now. I'm getting along at work. Everything is totally different, and I feel much freer.' But what about the real thing? They mean, when do I get enlightened?" And of course, they are walking the path of enlightenment, non-reactivity, but their understanding is partial. In time, if the work continues, they'll see that the process itself is the real thing. It is the gateless gate. The capacity of great Satori, that's not going to happen to the average person. The person who has great opening is someone who has been almost selfless for years, and maybe that last little chunk drops off. I mean, great Satori doesn't fall out of the skies. This is a quote from a bigger interview, but I thought we could start with that, in part because I wanted to make a point about this being more porous, or like I like to say sometimes, being more transparent. In a way, that's another way of saying being present. If you want to, if it's too cold, we can turn that on. Okay, we'll turn that on.
Yeah, thanks.
See, because if we're present, then there is no us to be present. We're just presence or awake. We are just this moment as it is. It's when we get in the way of this moment that all sorts of difficulties occur. If I say it differently, when we get in the way of this functioning that is our life, when we add something else into that called me and not me, my life and not my life, what I want and what shouldn't happen to me and what should happen to me and what, and you fill in, then all sorts of difficulties occur. Even though we're never talking about anything but this moment that is our life. And yet we find ourselves wanting all sorts of other than right now, other than simply being the way it is. Something special. Even if that something special is something called great enlightenment experiences. Now, of course, things like that occur. They're little ones and big ones, but if we make a big deal out of it, then we're off to the races, as we say. So, having said that, I wanted to give this opportunity for us to explore a little bit after having had a break, so to speak, for lunch, for walking, for whatever you did, for us to talk a little bit before we go back to sitting, talk not so much for the sake of talking as further clarifying what we're doing and what's happening. And then we'll go back. Yeah.
So this week, I don't know if it's because Joko died, but there's been a lot of articles popping up on the internet. There was an interview I was sharing at lunch, an interview with her, and she said, sometimes my students come in and they say, I had this great opening. And she says, that's wonderful. How are you getting along with your mother?
That's right. Now, if we have great opening and we're completely open, if you take that word, then where is there any problems with mothers? See, if we have problems with others, then it's our not being open to them being the way they are. It doesn't mean you have to agree with others. It doesn't mean any particular thing, but what is it? What is opening? We're opening up this self-centeredness that refuses to be awake, that refuses to be present. That's why we use words like opening, which is a translation of a word that sometimes is translated as seeing true nature or being true nature. But of course, we hear the words and we get pictures in our head of what that's going to be, and then we read things where people make a big deal of it, which of course it is sometimes when it happens. There's this big deal, and then that calms down. You know, we say that big deal becomes a golden chain that blinds you. It's like the traditional story, it's like someone who for a while thinks they've lost their head and goes all around looking for where their head is. Where is my head? And asks everyone, where is my, did you see my head? Did you see my head? Finally, someone decides, and he gives him a slap, and he says, oh, I found my head. And he runs around so happy and excited, and he tells everyone, isn't it great? I found my head. I found my head. I found my head. And people say, yeah, sure, okay. And then finally, it goes back to, okay, it's no big deal. My head's right here. And then just go on and do what you do. So. We've all had lunch break, nothing to say. That's okay. I'll go back into my little room and continue there. But. Yeah.
Let's talk. Can you talk about uncertainty?
What does that mean?
The next thing beyond this being unknown.
What about? That's the way it is. See, the truth is, even this right here, we don't know, except that we think we know. We think we know what this is. The more we hold on to what we know, the more we can see what is, except to the extent that fits what we know. And even then, we often can't see it, except we see what we already know. But we're often unwilling to not know. We're often unwilling to be the intimacy of not knowing. There's a Zen koan story case which the final phrase is, not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing is really what our life is. And yet we want our life to be somehow special, somehow different, somehow extraordinary, as opposed to just being ordinary, just being simple, just being poor. I don't mean poor in monetary, but poor in the sense that we don't have anything that we have to hold on to. Therefore, we can do see what needs to be done right here. What is right here? or we can breathe this breath. But to the extent that we hold on, we can't breathe this breath. We can't lift up this arm. If we're fighting this all along, it becomes very hard even just to lift our arms. So our daily functioning becomes harder because we have all sorts of breaks, and B-R-A-K-E, on our life. We have all sorts of expectations or beliefs that hinder us, reactive habits that keep us from responding as our life this moment.
So just speak about not knowing in a sense of fearing loss, like you lose a person, you lose an ability, a
yeah.
function of your body. You know, I mean, we've got a lot of that knowing as we age that we don't know, you know, how much we're this degenerate or whether you're lose something. What is this effective strategy to embrace or be open to loss? Fear of loss. Even
yeah. See, that's a very good word. Fear.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult if we can't face our fear for us to do what needs to be done. Because the fear becomes, like I said, a break.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes a hindrance from doing the best we can within the capacity of how it is now. No, I'm no longer 18, so I can't do whatever I could have done when I was 18. And yet sometimes I think I should still be able to be 18 or 28 or whatever. If we fear whatever we're going to lose, if we fear how will I take care of it, we are holding on to this idea of I, as opposed to the I of right now, in the conditions the way I am right now, whether I'm 80 or 18.
So we're making it should be a different way. Is that what you
yes.
mean? Holding on to it.
We hold on. We have expectations. We believe our expectations. We get upset. I don't say there isn't pain. I don't say there isn't loss of functioning.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Joko was 80, she was able to teach a certain way. When she was 85, she wasn't able to do what she had done when she was 80.
Sure.
When she was 90, she no longer could function the way she could when she was 85.
Right.
When we're, however we are, we have certain, we are the product of cause and effect. That means all sorts of conditions come together as this moment of our life.
Sure.
Mental, physical, etc., social. To inhabit that and do our best out of now.
Right. What is the strategy for that? You've lost a lot.
Then you grieve. And in the midst of grieving, what enables you to do what needs to be done now? Whether it's to be able to grieve, whether it's to be able to be with people in the midst of that, whether it's to do the work that you choose to do or don't choose to do. See? So it's the supports around you, the supports so-called inside you, and working with the expectation, I should be able to, or I should have been able to, or they shouldn't have, or I shouldn't be grieving. And it's both in terms of gaining capacities and losing capacities.
Good point.
You know, it's when you graduate high school, when you graduate college, you all of a sudden have different capacities and opportunities. But if you're ahead of yourself or behind yourself, then you're not where you are. And the point is always being where you are, you can live your life more fully.
I just wanted to say, Paul died not too long ago, and when he was looking like he was going to die, I said to Elihu, well, it's a slippery slope, and he said, the slope goes both ways. And so for me, that really meant, you know, just to be present, because we don't know. We just don't know.
That mean the slope goes both ways?
The slope goes both ways? So it goes this way and it goes that way.
But in terms of you, what does it mean? What does it mean?
It meant to be simply present. Okay. It goes both ways. I didn't know which way it was going to go.
See, if we have an idea of what's going to happen, I lost this, therefore, then, you know, if we have an idea of what our life's going to be and what it means if such and such happens in my life, that much we live out of a story of who I was, who is still now, who I should be like, or what. Look at all this that I'm losing. See, we have a whole story there of who I am, what I have, what I don't have, what I should have.
Sure.
And we're endlessly suffering then, endlessly, because we could never match pictures, because reality is constantly changing. And yet we want to live in our pictures and stories and self-centeredness, as opposed to being awake now. Okay.
I just want to stick with that for one more second. I think what you're saying, or what I'm understanding, is that if this happens, then this might happen. This is where the fear comes up.
Yes.
You know, this anticipation of what might be or what will be, or, you know, which gets into the thinking about the future and planning and trying to prevent and protect.
And fear is a natural reaction. There's no problem with, you know, if you're going on ski slopes and it's the first time you've ever skied, fear is there, maybe. If it's there, it's there. And it's just part of this bigger functioning of who we are. And it's the same with all sorts of fears. Fears just arise. There's no problem with fears, except if the fears, if we don't have the fear in the midst of our life, but it becomes the whole of who we are. It becomes what we attach to and keep on carrying in front of us. As opposed to, all sorts of things come up. Just like that sound of that bus passing by, just kind of comes up. No problem. I continue speaking, you continue listening, despite the fact that a bus comes through. But if I say, and get caught up in the fear about the bus that just came through and that what's going to come next, then all of a sudden I don't hear, I can't speak, etc. But unfortunately, fear is a habit that we generate out of self-centeredness. And our practice opportunity is to be willing to sit in the midst of our life, whether formal sitting or in all our life, in the midst of fear appearing.
It's just something you say, fear is a habit, and I agree. But we practice because of self-centeredness. It sounds like because we're, and I know you don't mean this bad,
no.
Self-centeredness, we're just, I mean, to me it's a habit we've all learned, but isn't it in some ways a mistaken way of thinking we're going to help ourselves? I better be frightened about this, I might take better care of myself, I better be, it's like, it's not a very effective habit, but not because we're bad. I mean, self-centeredness always has that
a negative connotation.
Yeah.
Self-centeredness is a, it's not, there's no blame involved. All it is, what should I say, pointing out what's so. It's like labeling thoughts. Self-centeredness is a, what should I say, a generalization about a whole bunch of things that keep connecting to this idea of self, which is a fiction which we believe. It's nothing wrong with saying I do such and such, but it's a fiction in the sense of holding on to the story that there's this solid me from when I was 10, 11, 12, 5, 15, etc. till now.
So that's what you mean by self-centeredness.
Yeah.
The fiction, the story you tell versus it's entrapped in a story or a fiction versus your arrogance or your evilness or whatever else.
Those are just habits of mind. Self-centeredness itself is habit of mind.
Oh yeah, it's cause and effect. It's just, I think there's so much connotation. Selfish, self-centeredness as being part of evil, harmful.
I don't like to use the word evil.
I don't. I'm trying to come up with something.
It's fine to use the word harmful in the sense of cause and effect, consequences. In other words, if I drink poison, that's harmful.
Sure.
And in the same sense, certain amount of self-centeredness is poisonous. It poisons my life. It poisons my ability to be with other people.
Sure.
It poisons my ability to see what I need to do.
Well, now that I know your definition is this fiction, the story you're telling. Now I get that when you're talking about that, I haven't always understood that. So,
The only problem with saying it's a fiction is that we are so sure, body, mind, that it's the truth. We are so sure of who we are. And that's why Joko uses the word porous. We become more porous. The self-image, the self-habit, becomes more porous, and it's able to be in the world. We're able to be awake with others
as we practice,
as we live.
Yeah.
So being porous is good in the sense, because it means that you can admit the light of what's going on. You could exude the functioning of what your life is. Say a little louder so that everyone could hear, including me.
With the more difficult feelings that come up, that one could maybe say could dovetail into this idea of just letting go, and you don't want to go there, the anger, the sadness, the pain. Isn't it sort of inevitable that you would start to recognize and feel it by sitting only?
Yeah. And see what to do with it. But it's not only sitting, it's not sitting only. Sitting carries along into the rest of your life. If you just sit and then you say, but I'm going to continue doing whatever I do in the rest of my life, then in a way the sitting becomes like a hobby. It's something you do, but you're not really being sitting in the rest of your functioning. So in a sense, sitting is one aspect of our practice, but our sitting has to permeate our functioning. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're doing a little, some tricky, nice habit that it's a hobby there, but we don't let that be in the rest of our life. So,
how does it permeate? How can it permeate? How do you let it permeate?
Because you start seeing what you're doing and what you're not doing. You start seeing when you're caught up and you make other choices. You start being present, and out of being present, you genuinely can't keep doing certain things because you can't fool yourself. You can't indulge yourself in the anger as much at a certain point. Maybe only after 5 days do you notice how caught up in anger you've been about what someone said to you a week ago. But at this point, when you do notice that, you see the consequences of continuing to hold on to that. But if you choose to, it's fine. You get the consequences. Okay. Enough talking. So we'll sit some more, and I will see those who I haven't seen yet. So, in charge.